Hello and welcome to today's program on the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Stoking the Creative Fires with Phil Cousineau. And I'm going to give you a brief introduction to Phil, and then I'm going to turn it over to him. We will be having audience questions at about quarter to seven. I will have a handheld mic that I'll be passing around for people, and then we'll finish about 10 past 7 to 7:15. So just to let you know a little bit, if you don't already know, Phil Cousineau is a writer, teacher, editor, independent scholar, documentary filmmaker, travel leader, and storyteller. His lifelong fascination with the art, literature, and history of culture has taken him on many journeys around the world. He lectures frequently on a wide range of topics, from mythology, film, and writing to beauty, travel, sports, and creativity. He's published more than 20 nonfiction books and has more than 15 scriptwriting credits to his name. And I'd just like to say that personally I'm very excited to have Phil here. I have been reading Phil's books for a number of years and got to meet him last year and had first known his work through his connection with Joseph Campbell, and then kept finding these amazing, cool books that were so exciting, and they all had Phil Cousineau's name on them. So I'm really excited to have him here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming. Are you sure you're in the right room? It's quite some competition we have here tonight. Not just Noam Chomsky, but also my team, the Tigers, are in the 10th inning against the Twins right now. Tied 5-5 the last time I looked. So it's a night that will be converging in a lot of interests, passions, and imaginations, right? So let's begin at the beginning. I was lucky enough to be born into the Paris of the Midwest, Detroit, in the 1950s. Pause dramatically. Because I was raised in a family of storytellers and book lovers. And the family ritual, which I just reconfirmed with my mother recently, because I can sometimes, like the rest of us, be accused of mythologizing my own past, right? They turned the television off every Friday night of my entire youth, whether it was Gunsmoke or the Tigers game. And my father dramatically walked across the carpet after asking my mother to pour a strong Jack Daniels for him on the rocks and would pull down one of the classics that he loved so much. And we grew up reading one book, one page, one child, one parent at a time, all the way through Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, Mark Twain, F. Scott Fitzgerald, many of the greats. And any time that I would, or any of us, would hear or read a word that we weren't quite familiar with, I remember my hand going up and saying, "Dad, what does shenanigans mean in Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn? And he would point over to the thick doorstop-sized Thorndike Barnhart Family Dictionary and say, "Go read the dictionary. That's why I bought the damn thing." And I realized that this was a pedagogic trick that he had that was actually quite beautiful. Rather than telling me the answer, he wanted me to have the pleasure of teaching myself, learning myself. This got into me my entire youth, and also when I had my first newspaper job, 16 years old, local newspaper, Wayne Dispatch, which went all the way back to the Civil War. They needed a young buck sports writer and photographer, so they asked me. And it was right in the middle of basketball season, and I remember scoring 25 points one night against St. Agatha, downtown Detroit, 19 rebounds, getting on the phone, interviewing five or six teams about the local basketball, baseball, wrestling scores, bringing all the notes to the newspaper office and sitting down with my editor, Roger Turner, and saying, "Roger, I know the deadline's now. I have all my notes." And he looked at my notes, and I remember to this day, he said, "Phil, when it's ink, it's real." In other words, just to have the idea up here is never enough. Igor Stravinsky once said, "One of the most magnificent aspects of being a human being is the ability to move from inspiration to realization, pulling an idea out of your head and somehow turning it into a book, architecture plans, a business plan, a movie script, whatever it might be." And that's what I want to explore tonight, because to be creative has been at the core of my life with books and films and now a TV show. But the notion is, after you've been inspired, how do you keep moving to actually complete something? I just heard some wonderful comments before the talk began here. A young man, right? Telling me that a common situation or problem in the business world is how to keep an entire office or a business passionate and imaginative. And that's been an issue in my life, both as a writer and a filmmaker, a coach, because I love coaching kids sports, baseball and basketball, but also when I'm a consultant down in the Hollywood studios. I'm consulting in a multitude of films now, and the problems follow a pattern. And the pattern has to do with being on fire and having the ability, the moxie, the capacity to stoke, kindle, continually relight that fire until the work is done. So one of my favorite writers inspired the whole writing of this particular book, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once said, "Genius is the power for lighting your own fire." In other words, not waiting for Ed McMahon to come and knock on your door. Here's a $300,000 grant, Phil, or here's two more days in a month, Mr. Cousineau. Mr. McMahon is not going to knock on my door. So I, like everyone else, has to find a way to ignite that fire. And what I'm going to try to convey tonight is that the ability to visualize where you are on any particular project increases your ability, your capacity to complete it by probably a hundredfold. People who drop books, films, business plans are those who can't see it in their mind's eye anymore. You know that feeling? Well, I had an image. I knew what I wanted to do with this book, with this business plan, but I can't even see it anymore. So can we bring the lights down, Kevin? Is that possible? If not, then I'll go
better,
with this.
Better to leave it as this.
Okay. So let's go. The notion with my idea of creativity is that it's a journey. And if you can look at any project that you have embarked on as a journey, with a beginning, middle, and end, a three-act structure, if you like. You can think of it in terms of my old mentor and friend Joseph Campbell's notion of the hero's journey. It can be a dramatic journey, since most creativity projects tend to be quite dramatic, right? Here, this is a wonderful painting by my friend Greg Chadwick of a monk walking across a hill in downtown San Francisco. All creativity is a search, as in this wonderful Gauguin painting that he did in Polynesia, trying to really restoke the passion in his own life when he had to leave his friends, his family, his job as a banker. Did you know he began as a banker in Paris? His work as a painter, because he thought the whole bourgeois world in Paris was pulling him down. It was too much of a monochromatic life. So he went, as I think we all do, in search of what he called a lullaby of color. Isn't that a magnificent phrase? He wanted to leave monochromatic Europe in search of a lullaby of color, in search, he said, of a sensuality of creativity. Now, can you live with that one? Not just any creativity, but a creativity that is full of passion, is full of sensuality. This search is step by step. You know, Carrie Fisher, from Star Wars and all her books, she recently said, in America today, immediate gratification just ain't fast enough. So we begin a project and we wonder why we can't write a novel in a week. We begin a new series of paintings and we're sometimes devastated when we hit a roadblock. My idea here is that we go step by step, footprint by footprint. I led a pilgrimage a few years ago in honor of Gandhi and Thomas Merton with Father John Deere. He's an activist Jesuit priest whose life is about to be told by Martin Scorsese in a new movie. And after we walked in this pilgrimage from Gethsemane to Louisville, Kentucky. It was about 100 miles in 6 days or so. when we reached Louisville at the Muhammad Ali Museum, who asked us to finish our peace pilgrimage there because he said, I began my life as a man of violence and I'm going to end it as a man of peace. Would you please end your journey here? One of the women on our pilgrimage took our footprints and later turned all of our footprints into a magnificent quilt, which will commemorate all of our footsteps walking this 100 miles. And that, in a sense, is the creative journey. It's the marking of a step by step, page by page, or as Anne Lamott likes to say, bird by bird, right? Color by color, stroke by stroke. What I want to help with a little innovative thought here, though, is if you look up at the clock right there, that's chronological time. That is clockwise. We got that from the Greeks, but the Greeks had 9 gods of time, not just Kronos. They're god of time for creativity and synchronicity, for sacred journeys and for athletics and for drama was Kairos. Kairos was the god of sacred time, and sacred time goes counterclockwise. So this was one of my mentor Joe Campbell's great innovation, that the hero's journey, the dramatic journey, the traveler's journey, and now what I'm saying is the creative journey goes against time. That means you have to find a way to control in a sacred, in a respectful way, control the time in your life, or time will make you a victim. So anytime you say, oh, I'd love to see you, Kevin, for a coffee, but you know, man, I'm really busy. Jesus, I've got so much going on. How many times in the course of a week do we say that? I'm too busy to meet with you, sweetheart, for a private dinner. Oh, I've got too much going on, so I can't really squeeze in one more thing. Every time we speak like that, we are cutting back our opportunities to be creative and soulful. So here it goes. The creative journey is against time. That's why creativity is tough. It's difficult. It goes against the grain, against the wind, as my main man Bob Seger from Detroit used to sing, against the wind, right? And it's a journey from the waking into the dream world, from the day into the night world. And if you follow it with a sense of integrity and authenticity, it will feel like you are stopping time. So have any of you had that wonderful, delicious feeling of 4 or 5 hours disappearing when you're writing, painting, singing, working on a business plan? When you're in that, what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, I think that's how you pronounce his name, out of the University of Chicago, calls flow. Flow is the goal in all athletics and in all of the arts and in many religious traditions. So we're going to be following this step by step here. It's another way to think about it. The Ouroboros in alchemy is another way to think about this, that our lives are incomplete if we aren't creative. Do you remember Bob Dylan once saying, he who ain't busy being born is busy dying? I'm modifying that for this way of thinking, that he or she who isn't busy being creative is slowly dying. So let's do a quick little alert here on the word creative. I just finished a new book on words, word origins. And, of course, in every book and film that I begin, I have to go into the words. And I thought I knew what creativity meant, the origin of the word, but I was stunned and delighted when I went to the dictionary. My father would have been proud. Create comes from the old Latin creare, which means to grow. If you are creating, you are growing as a human being. The people in your office are growing together as a team. If you are not creating, you're slowly moving backwards. The secondary meaning for it is to make order out of the chaos. People who are creative often have a jumbled, chaotic mind. If you could spend 1 minute in my writing studio, you know what I'm talking about. Thousands of books, thousands of journals, and sometimes my desperation to be creative is this passion to find some order and some meaning in all the chaos of all those ideas. 9 fires. That's how I'm thinking of creativity. Inspiration is the first fire. We all feel a little flare once in a while, like the morning Paul McCartney woke up with this little jingle in his head. We all live in India. And he immediately called Ringo Starr on the phone and said, Ringo, I think I have a song for you, because he didn't really want to sing it. But there's the inspiration. It can come up. The choreographer, Twyla Tharp, has now choreographed 199 dances. And she says, I don't have a lack of inspiration. I have an overabundance of inspiration. The idea is to get it down and move into the second stage of reverie. Do you have a practice of reverie? Some people like long walks. Some people like to read or listen to music. Some people like to run. The reverie, as Gaston Bachelard, the wonderful French philosopher, said, is the ability to move from the waking and inspired world into the real world. And once you have moved through reverie, you have deeply and truly experienced something. Time and space, that's the third stage. Are you in control of time and space? What's the role or the place for muses and mentors in your world? Focus, can you focus? The other side, the shadow side of focus, is burnout. A big question that I'll go into in the next few minutes here. If you're stuck, especially if you're angry, anxious, confused, you may be in the wrong work. Annie Dillard, even Stephen King has written about this beautifully. If you get stuck in a manuscript or a business plan, it doesn't mean stop being a writer or a businessman. You may have to shift into another work, another project. And then the last two, and I'm going to be dilating on all these, a cooling off period. Anybody who's a long distance bike rider, as my friend Gary in the back knows exactly what I'm talking about, you need a cooling off period before you walk in the house. Same thing with creativity. And then the final stage is the passing of the torch. In my experience, people who are generous with their time and their gift after they have completed a project and spend some time helping others, usually in their field, are the ones who stay productive and creative their entire life. But people who hoard their talent, hoard the gift, get stuck over and over when they finish something. So the inspiration can come from outside. It can come from God or the gods or nature. This is an old stone site in the west of Ireland called Pool na Brann. And the old tradition here was that if you needed inspiration as a poet or a warrior or a chieftain or a bard, you would go, as they said, to the old stones. And they had one particular ritual for poets and bards and musicians who were really stuck and they had lost their voice. The druid priests would take them out onto one of these old stone sites and tie them by a rope to the top of this dolmen, leave them there in a thunder and lightning storm, come back the next morning, and as the old tradition said, find them either dead, mad, or a poet. So this gives you a little hint of the extent that human beings have been going to for inspiration. Sometimes the inspiration comes from within. People have deep meditative or contemplative practices, often don't need that grant from the Guggenheim. They don't need to go to Paris. They don't need all that new software that the computer companies want you to buy, because this will help you with your breakthrough. Sometimes it comes from the world of your own dreams. This wonderful painting by Lila Carlson, she's a local painter here. The reverie. This is actually the eye of a needle. And above it is, in honor of my Tigers tonight, a ball player who is the size of a grain of rice, painted by an Armenian micro-miniature sculptor. He and his entire village in Armenia have specialized in this for hundreds of years. His name is Hagop Handelman, and I have the photo in the book if you want his story. But the reason I say it is because he had come to America to play cello for the LA Symphony, couldn't get a job, so he resorted, as a lot of us do, if we can't express ourselves in one field, You move around. You say, where else can I express myself? For him, it wasn't a guitar. He wasn't trying to fill Jim Morrison's footsteps. But instead, he went of his own accord, as the imagination will move, if you allow it to a form of creativity that his people had always practiced. And so over the years, he carved hundreds of little pieces like this, the entire Quran, the Taj Mahal, and so on. Painting, by the way, with his own hair, fibers of his own hair, and using crushed rubies as paint. So why do I use this image? Because when his wife and his kids and the people from the L.A. County Art Museum, who gave a magnificent exhibition of his in the 70s, said, when you watched Hagop work on these grains of rice, you never saw his hands or his head move. You could watch him for 2 hours, and he was lost. He was lost in his thoughts. He was lost in his own attempt to try to reconnect with the creativity of his ancestors. That's reverie. To be lost in your thoughts. Do you have that capacity in your life right now? Often, I talk to people who have hundreds of ideas for books and films and photography and so on and so on, but they don't have that next step, that desire to meditate on that work and go into a reverie, and in the middle of that reverie begins the percolating of the actual work. One example, Chandler, if you have any Raymond Chandler fans here, I found a book of his a few years ago that was fantastic. It was a collection from his notebooks in which he had pages and pages and pages just of possible book titles in the future, and then pages and pages of names of characters, and then quirks of behavior. And then he would meditate on these. He would usually go to the bar, to be honest. And while at the bar, he would go through the notebooks and say, oh, farewell, my honey. No, not that. Farewell, my honey. Farewell, my lovely. And that's how a book is born. The ability to trust and really respect your capacity for reverie. The next in a huge stumbling block in our time, in our era, is time. Are you in control of your time? This is the god Kairos right here. He has wings. There was an old phrase in ancient Greece that said, when Kairos enters the room, seize him quickly. You know the famous saying, seize the day? That's the Roman equivalent of the earlier Greek. The earlier Greek notion was seize the moment. Don't even wait for the day. The moment comes when you have that inspiration for the new idea, new business plan, new piece of sculpture, new song. And the people who are creative and prolific and feel vital are the ones who seize that moment. Likewise, do you have a sacred space? Have you used that word? Every prolific creative person I know has an inviolate corner of their apartment, their home, maybe the local cafe, where everyone knows. That's where Kevin goes. That's his. That's Joe's corner. That's Gary's corner of the cafe. This is Pierre Renoir's writing studio. And this is the chair in which he spent the last 10 years of his life, because he had such a crippling arthritis. His hands were as gnarled as the olive trees that I noticed in his backyard. So bad, as a matter of fact, that every morning, his wife had to put the paintbrush into his hand and tie the paintbrush like this so it wouldn't fall out of his hand. And then she had to nail his coat to this chair. And you think, this is a horrible, horrible destiny for this eminently talented man. So his biographer and his art agent came to him one day, Villard, and said, Pierre, this is terrible news. You look awful. And apparently Renoir just looked up to him and said, are you kidding? I'm the happiest man in Nice, France right now, because there's nothing I have to do for the rest of my life but paint. Now all the excuses are gone, right? So space. Are you in control of the space? Or are you fighting with your wife, your husband, your girlfriend, your boyfriend? You can't use the table for this and that. Space is a huge issue, as well as focus. You're doing the research. This is, of course, Rodin's thinker. one of my father's favorite sculptures. This is in Paris. But I use it for almost a meditative device because I was stunned to do some little work on this in my word book. Focus comes from the old Latin word for the hearth. Think about that for a moment. Hundreds of thousands of years of human beings sitting in front of a fire, maybe in a cave, maybe on the savannah, and then in small rooms, in hostelries, and pilgrim's inns. And what do you do when you look into a fire? You fall into a reverie, right? And generally, if there are people around you, you have a conversation. And you tend to get pretty honest in front of a fire. And you try to stay to one topic, as opposed to checking your BlackBerry or your CrackBerry, as they say nowadays. Focus. Can you focus? Do you have a focusing technique? Or are you honest with yourself about your capacity? For some people, there's a great story. Gertrude Stein was once interviewed about how she was able to possibly create or finish 35 novels and books of poetry and short stories in her life. And she said, I never wrote that much, but I wrote for 30 minutes a day, 6 days a week, for 40 years. You feel that? There was no sense of resentment, but her sense was of the sacred time for the work was inviolate. She knew her capacity. For others, it's long bursts, like Jack Kerouac's famous burst of 21 straight days of writing on the road. Are you honest and self-evaluating with your capacity for focus and for contemplation? Contemplation is a little different than meditation. Meditation is a practice in which you just allow thoughts just to keep moving. Move through. Don't identify with them, right? Let them go. Let them go. Like the water moving through. But contemplation is the power of focus on a single idea at a time. This is an image I took in Taiwan last November when I was working on a film about tea. And we were interviewing five of the last authentic old Taiwanese tea masters who told us in beautiful rhapsodic terms that the power of tea in old Chinese tradition isn't just the sharing of the delight of these fantastic oolongs and pu'ers and all these fancy teas, but it's the capacity for tea to bring people together to be creative. Creative in terms of their poetry, their painting, their conversation. Do you have a contemplative life? We all know the notion of the muse, but I use this in my book, the Stoking the Creative Fires book, in this sense, that if you've begun a project, you've gotten moving on it, you've carved out some precious time and space in your life, but it's not going the way you want. It just doesn't have an authentic voice to it. Sometimes it can feel like someone else is writing your book or painting your paintings or singing your songs. Often that can happen if you're still trying to please someone in your distant past. A few years ago, I was writing a book, Once and Future Myths, in which I was trying to, in a sense, take the baton from my old friend Joe Campbell. And I realized the night before I was supposed to hand it in, as I was rereading it, that it sounded like Campbell. And I went into the absolute drenched sweats on this. I went into a panic on it. And I walked around North Beach for hours and hours. And I remember walking back up Telegraph Hill where Joe and I live. By the time I reached the top of the hill, I realized I had to rewrite the book. 340-page book I had to rewrite because it wasn't my voice. This can happen to any of us. What did I do? I realized as I was walking around that my voice, which we all have to search for, is the voice, talking about mythology, is the one that I use when I'm leading groups around Greece, Turkey, France. That storytelling voice in which I try to make Sisyphus come alive in Corinth and so on. So for the next 6 weeks, I used every excuse in the book to keep my editor at bay. So, my dog's sick, my kid's sick, my mom's sick, oh, the car ran out of gas. I went through every imaginable excuse, but I bought my time. And then the book that came out is really mine. It's my voice. But it's not just me. You know, there's a famous story about Ray Charles going through this too, in which he had released several albums in which he had sold millions. He was rich. He was driving, or he was being driven around in a fantastic Lincoln Continental and so on. And one evening, Ahmet Ergut, the famous president of Atlantic Records, had him in his office and says, Ray, I know it's time for another album, but, you know, I don't want another album like the last three. And Ray Charles was saying, but they sold and they sold and they sold. And he said, yeah, but Ray, you still sound like Nat King Cole. And apparently Ray Charles was mortified because he knew it. And he had to go and find his own voice. So if you are in that predicament of sounding too much like your father, your mother, your old English teacher, a flute teacher, a coach, everybody goes through this. The question is, how do you break out of it and find your voice? The embodiment of the nine muses in old Greek mythology is one way. I spent a whole chapter on this in the book that I think helps us break out of it. Each one of the nine muses is a personification of one of the art forms. And what they were used for in ancient times was inspiration. If you needed to be inspired as a playwright, you might go to hear not just a play or witness a play there in the agora, outside the agora of Athens, but you might go and listen to Herodotus speak the histories. This is called cross-learning. Do you ever use that term, cross-learning now, in which you're stuck in one form? It could be music. Read some poetry. If you're a writer, put the writing down for a while. Move to the side. Go see plays for 3 or 4 weeks. That's what the muses have been able to do for human beings for millennia. They embody nine different ways for us to be inspired in any period of our life. And I find that breathtakingly beautiful and also a little ominous, because if you really take it to heart, you have no more excuses for being stuck. In other words, every day, especially in a place like the Bay Area where we live, or New York, the great metropolitan areas, every day, every night, there is a way to spark your dormant creativity. Still, if you move through a project that's authentic as opposed to just being a commodity, a way to earn some name recognition, a brand recognition, a term I hate, I suspect there are two ways to get into the labyrinth. One is that you are lost because it's the wrong project, and that hurts. Dorothea Brandy, whose book on writing, or Becoming a Writer, 1938, is probably still the most beautiful and bona fide book on writing. She says, if you are stuck in a piece of writing for a long period of time, stop. You could hurt somebody. Isn't that a stunning line? You know what she means? We get angry when we're not creative, when we're not really fulfilling our own potential. But she goes on to say, don't stop being a writer. Stop that project. Move off to the side. That's what I mean by the labyrinth. The labyrinth is one of the most ancient images of confusion, anxiety, the path of the soul that sometimes gets stuck. Why do you get stuck? Because you are approaching this character, the Minotaur. Greg has just painted this for my word book. And the Minotaur, of course, is the half-man, half-bull image in Greek myth, but it's also the personification of the thing, the power that you have to slay in order to find your authentic voice. If you like psychological language, it could be the ego. You need to slay the ego. You're too closely identifying with my book. It's my business, and don't you touch my business. You know that ferocity that can come in? And I mean ferocity with this. The Minotaur could also be your sense of self-doubt or self-worth. Oh, God, who am I to put a record out in the world, right? Who am I to start a new business? The Minotaur has to be confronted. If you want to continue to grow deeper with your work, there is a way to fake it till you make it, where you find one groove in your particular creative endeavor and you just repeat yourself over and over again. We can do it, and we all know people who've done it and have found a lucrative way to live. But I'm trying to talk about another way in which we are trying to become better people by being more and more creative. better men and women, better kids, better partners. This is the other side of focus, in which you focus so intensely, so ferociously that you burn out. I spent 5 years working on a book about Jim Morrison and the Doors, and I heard that story 10 ways from Sunday, as Grandma used to say, and found that in the year Jim died, 1971, four rock and rollers all died that year at the age of 27. Jimmy, Janice, Jim, and Keith. I don't even have to use the last names. With this hip crowd, right? You know who I'm talking about. The guy at the piano here is Brian Wilson, who I went to see when I was showing one of my films at the Sundance Film Festival in 1995, and he had not performed, I think, for 20 years in public. He had gone through a psychosis after finishing the Pet Sounds album. He was about to release this in the world, and he was becoming a little messianic with his own genius. This does happen, where we think our work is going to change the world, right? This is it, man. This is the day before he was about to release Pet Sounds, the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's. And he could get no attention for this album, which we now know is one of the greats of all time, but it disappeared. And he slowly descended in a kind of vertigo of depression. And it took him 20-odd years to come out of it. So a man who had just finished a film about his life, and they convinced Brian to come and sing two or three songs at this piano at the Sundance Film Festival. We all crowded around the piano, and it was one of the loveliest but also most painful experiences I've ever been involved in, because he was so mortified. He was so shy, you could barely hear that voice. Remember that sweet little song, God Only Knows? It's one of the great ballads from the 60s. You had to lean forward to hear him. But he was coming out of this deep depression. A few weeks later, he was on Charlie Rose, because he had finally released the album that he had worked on now all those years, Alone in Private, the Smile album. And Charlie says, Brian, why did it take you so long to release this album? And Brian Wilson, the former lead singer of the Beach Boys, says, the world wasn't ready yet. So sometimes we know we have created something phenomenal, and we may have to be a little careful about when and where we release it. But the burnout is something serious. The sense of doubt. This is an image of Lorca, the great poet, who also brought back the notion of the duende. The doubt and duende, these are these blood forces that allow us to go deeper and deeper with the work. Sisyphus is a huge image in my own mythology. I love the Greek sense of him having to push the boulder up to the top of the hill. And then the big question is, what is your attitude? What is your attitude towards the inevitable fact that the boulder is going to roll back down to the bottom of the hill? Are you going to sit there and cry like B.B. King, nobody loves me but my mama, and she could be jiving too? Or are you going to say, man, that's life, okay? My woman left me. My business went south. Katrina demolished my house. There are so many tragedies that can befall us. But as William James said in 1910, the great philosophical question of our time is, what is our attitude towards our own travails? What is our attitude? If we can be triumphant about it, which I think is one way to look at the blues and folk music, it's a sense of at least momentary triumph over life's inevitable tragedies. Then we can keep moving into what I call in this book, the real work. And it's a huge question for all of us. Why are we here? What are we doing with our time? Are we using our time well? Are we using our God-given talents, potentials, and fire? Or are we waiting, waiting, waiting for Ed McMahon? Or to have a little more money, or a little more time, or for the economy to be better? What is the real work of our life? This is what Paul Gauguin asked himself when he went back for the second time to Tahiti. And right near the end of his life, I believe it was in the last week of his time in Morea, in the Tahitian Islands, when he was racked with syphilis, and he created this enormous, iconic painting, which he ended up calling Where Do We Come From? Why Are We Here? Where Are We Going? These are the great philosophical questions everybody has to wrestle with. And in some way, I think every work of art is addressing, at least tacitly. If you listen to Beethoven's symphonies, it's full of an attempt to respond to questions like this. I'm going to New York in 2 weeks, and in between some book events and this and that, I'm looking forward to going to the Met, because I think it's the Rijksmuseum in Holland has released The Milkmaid, one of the 35 paintings that we have of Vermeer, one of the great affirmations of the human adventure. And I will make one little pilgrimage to the Met while I'm there in New York, because I've seen this painting 5 or 6 times in my life, and every time I'm brought to tears by not just the beauty and the majesty of the work, but also Vermeer's attempt to answer these primal questions. You think that someone who can paint this or paint like Vermeer or compose like Beethoven or Paul McCartney must have everything going for him. But you know, Vermeer was the father, I think, of 13 children. The city where he lived was racked by war, by fire, by pestilence. And yet, he went into himself and pulled out a sense of light. And light is one of the great metaphors of all the arts. In some way, in a profound level, I think this is what the creative journey is about. It's a search for light in the midst of the darkness. This is an image of Ansel Adams. And I had a great synchronicity a few years ago in which I had lunch with my dear friend and my son's honorary godfather, Houston Smith, and we were going to have a public event in a few days, and I said, Houston, I want to end this evening with one of those great overarching questions. You know, I wouldn't ask just anybody, but I have to ask you. He said, after 55 years of studying the world of religions, could you condense and compress it a little bit for me? What have you learned from all these studies? We've known each other a long time. I can ask him that. And without hesitation, he said, follow the light. A couple days later, I was in Ansel Adams' house in Carmel. This is an image of Ansel here. And there's a little index card on his enlarger, his motto, follow the light, within a couple days of each other. And that little instance has gotten into me, that there is something that is the burr in the soul, so to speak, of creative people, in which you take the world's darkness, you take your own individual darkness or confusion to heart and say, in my business, in my work, I am going to add at least a scintilla of light. If you're able to do this, you can achieve what I think, what the old Irish Druids used to call the fire in the head. This is that fabulous feeling of being alive because you are creating something. And this is important for me and a big distinction in my book and a lot of my work, it's the difference between self-expression and real creativity. Self-expression is something I think we should all do. We should all be expressing ourselves with our recipes at home. Take grandma's recipes and make it our own, right? Be self-expressive in the way that we decorate our homes, the way that we dress. Be expressive. In some way, we should all be writing, and we should all be sketching and using our creativity. But the creative urge is a step beyond that. It's an attempt, as bold and brazen as it may be, in which you say, I am going to drop this work into the world and see what happens. Even if you take to heart Robert Frost's famous line, he's publishing a book of poetry is like dropping a feather into the Grand Canyon. Once in a while, you have that feeling, right? What can I possibly create that would make a difference? Who knows? But we have to do it anyway. And if we do, we feel this tremendous sense of fire, being alive again. And it allows us to do something else. This is a great image of Denis Diderot, who created the first encyclopedia. And here's, I promise, not too many more of these, but this is one of my favorites. Encyclopedia means well-rounded knowledge. Say it again to yourself. The cyclo, as in cycle or bicycle. So to be encyclopedic doesn't mean just to be smart and a show-off. To be encyclopedic in the early Greek and then the French sense was to be well-rounded. In other words, be well-rounded spiritually, physically, mentally, artistically. And this is what sets the whole mind, body, soul on fire, if we're allowed, if we pursue that. It's a question for you as you commit to that great work. Do you love it? Do you love it? In every sense of the word, love. If you don't love it, no one's going to love it when they read it, hear it, see it, feel it as a piece of sculpture, walk into it as a piece of architecture. It's a high standard. But there's a lot of work that is being put out there. What is the old French saying? The épater la bourgeoisie. Let's just do it to shock the bourgeois, right? Or I'm going to show my dad. He wanted me to be a lawyer, but I'm going to be a poet anyway. God damn it. Right? Can't say that. But do you love it? We will know it if you put heart and soul into the work. And on a simple but profound level for me, some years ago, I went to chase track the Cousineau routes down to a little village in the south of France, which happened to be 5 minutes from the Lascaux Caves. And when I went into the caves, I was utterly stunned, as most people are, by the cavorting antelopes and the dreamy shaman-like characters. But what moved me most were the handprints. Handprints on the wall, blown, as you know, and then you'd take eagle bones, which are hollow, and you would blow paint through the eagle bone to have an imprint of the hand. So for at least 35,000 years, human beings have felt a compunction, that great old theological word, a compunction to leave our mark behind. This little print was made by my son, Jack, just a few years ago in a photography class in which the first assignment was to walk outside of the little building there in the Presidio and put a bunch of shapes, leaves, there's a nail there on top of the photographic paper, and allow the sun itself to create a photograph, what they call a sun print. And when I went to pick up my son that day, they were all the kids were trading their images back and forth. And I'd guess 3/4 of the kids had put their handprints on. No one had told them to. You feel how natural that is. This is what I'm trying to say again and again about the creative process. It isn't elite. It's as natural as breathing, as natural as the desire to grow, as natural as the desire to leave a mark behind. So I do a meditation like this a couple times a week, or sometimes I'll look at Jack, or I'll look at the books and films I've done, and I say, is this the mark I want to leave behind? It's a very good meditative question. You can say, have I made my major mark yet? Have I made my most honest mark in the world yet? Or, geez, is there any marks I've left behind that I'm a little ashamed of? Can I take a few back? Can I erase those marks? Yeah, we can be playful with this. And also, beauty. I'm sorry this isn't a better image, but it's of the it's not coming up very well here, but these are the mustard fields up in Napa Valley. And I use this as an image, and this and the next one, which I shot with infrared film in Arizona, about our ardent desire to seek beauty, not in the pop culture sense of being famous and being prettier than thou, but beauty in the oldest Greek and Roman sense of the property which affirms life. When you see something beautiful, when you create something beautiful, it's a kind of melody sent out across the world that says life is worth living. Beauty is at the heart of all creativity. In the Greek sense, they have this wonderful phrase, the aphroditic smile. Anything that has been done authentically, beautifully, attentively, has the smile of Aphrodite on it. What's the role of beauty in your life? Are you stretching yourself? I was stuck in a book about a year ago, and I was coming home from baseball practice with the kids in North Beach, and I saw the moon, full moon rising next to the pyramid building. And I had to blink twice because I looked at it and I looked at it again. And the moon that was rising next to the pyramid had 108 stitches on it, just like a baseball. And it was like an epiphany. I'm watching a baseball moon rising in San Francisco. But what it inspired me to do was write a little haiku poem about it. And then another one the next day. And before I knew it, I had written 50 or 60 baseball haiku and then created all these new baseball sketches to go along with it. I don't know where they came from. But I needed to do something outside of the book and the film that I was working on that brought me what? Sheer joy. So if you're taking notes, this is a big one to write down. If you're stuck, there's a 99.9% chance that you have squeezed the joy out of the work, and that's why you can't move. If you want to keep moving and you want to create something authentic, bring the joy back. And one good way that I've found out is to spend more time with kids. Kids will remind you about the joy of life, the joy of creativity. So if you can do something that's even 10 degrees to the side of your project that just makes you happy, that joy, that enthusiasm, in the Greek sense of being filled with the gods, it will leap across the spark plug, and it will inflame the other work in which you're stuck in. Money back guarantee. Art as the honoring of memory. My son goes to Cathedral School for boys, and the headmaster there, Michael Faribuff, asked if he could take me out for a beer one night. So we went out and we had two or three, and he showed me this photograph. And it turns out that he has been a kind of closet artist for years. And why? Because he feels a deep sense of pathos about what is being lost in the world. Some of his fondest memories are of exploring the attic in his grandparents' house. And he says, they're gone now, I can't do that. But he says, I can walk around to the antique shops around San Francisco. So we have our own Joseph Cornell in our own backyard. You know Cornell, the artist who walked for many, many years around Manhattan and the Bronx and Brooklyn looking for items to create his shadow boxes. So art, with no pretension towards being famous, is often an urge to honor memory. Once you've created the work, and you're going to sign off on it, you say, this is me, this is who I am at 15, 25, 35, 40, take me or leave me, this is how I sound, this is how I write. You want to move it out there in the world. Remember Carrie Fisher and immediate gratification? My suggestion is you hold on to it for a short time. Remember Chekhov, the great Russian short story writer and novelist, said, all true art is achieved through cool distance. Isn't that interesting? So you begin with a hot flame of being inspired. Your soul's on fire. Sometimes your fingertips are on fire. I can't wait to start writing today. Can't wait to get back to the studio and put something down on wax in the old days. But the art is achieved later by a sense of removal. Sometimes it's time, sometimes it's distance. Ernest Hemingway had to go to Paris to write about Michigan. And then he came back to the States and went to Michigan to write about Paris. Often our work can't breathe because there's no air. There's no distance there. So the cool fire is a little time I like to build into every piece of work where you sit on it. You sit on the album. You sit on the work. You meditate it on it for a short time. You tell your editor, give me a week. I need a week, right? You tell the gallery, I need to look at these one more time. There's some fantastic stories about how a lot of the Impressionists, some Renoir did this, Degas, a number of them, would hang their paintings in the Louvre, but they always had this agreement that they could go back after hours and touch up a little bit. So what's the old phrase? Anatole France once said, a book is never finished, it's only abandoned. That's part of the meditation on this, where you finally let go. Sometimes you might want to converse about it, like this old lithograph of Dr. Johnson at the Cheshire Cheese Inn in London, which is still there. So I recommend after you've finished a piece of work, talk about it with your friends. And have some distance. Don't get hurt if they say this isn't Shakespeare, right? This isn't Beethoven. Conversing, talking the work out, gives it some air, gives it some perspective. And then to close up the last couple of images here, as I hinted at the beginning, there is something equivalent, I think, in the creative world to postpartum blues for mothers. Anybody who has given birth or the husbands of those who have given birth know that this is a very serious and it's a quite profound stage of life, in which there is a kind of depression that can set in after giving birth to a human being, to a child. But there is the equivalent in the world of the arts as well. Hemingway was famous for having gone into paroxysms of depression after finishing a book, saying, you can see it in the journals and dialogues with Fitzgerald and so on, I'll never write again. Will I ever write again? Will I ever work again? Stravinsky went through this. Most do. It's a point of terror. David Lynch goes through these as well. So what I can pass on to you is something that has worked for me for a long time, that if you shift the focus from yourself, your genius, your talent, your 4 years finishing that baby, shift the focus. It's too hot. There's too much heat there. Move it to the side. Don't think about yourself, your next piece of work, your legacy, and so on. Instead, shift it. Ask to go and talk to kids. Gary and I have gone, and we've spent a lot of time talking to the classes of our kids. Go spend some time in a retirement home. And I was just did 6 cities in the Midwest, and I had 4 people come up to me in different cities saying, you know, I've been doing this, Mr. Cousineau. Yeah, I sing now in retirement homes. And every time I come back after singing to these people who are so grateful to have me there, I go home and I want to write a new song. You see what can happen? You pass the torch. This is the image of fire. You keep the fire moving. And if you do it that way, tell your story, share the gift, share your knowledge in business, create a mentorship program, rather than hoard the gold, which is something that we tend to do in American culture. We tend to be extremely territorial about our creativity, both in the arts and in business. And I think that's a problem culturally, versus this notion that it's all one great fire. And if you keep that moving, then the whole culture benefits. I have an image here now of Biosphere 2, because I was filming. This is the second film I've done on architecture, and I got a tour with Phil Hawes, the man who designed Biosphere 2. I had 6 hours with him, from the guts of the building to the Amazon rainforest at the top. And it was also the last day before it was closed for a few years. And I remember the last question I asked him as we were finishing the filming that day, well, what do you do with all this? You poured 22 years of your life into this project. Are you sad? Are you melancholic? Are you angry that the funding was cut off? And he says, no, I've learned so much from this that I can apply on a smaller scale now. So he's dedicating the rest of his life to using all the insights he gained from Biosphere 2 to creating small, sustainable communities throughout the Southwest. And teaching. You say, what I learned here, I'm going to pass on to others. that's a pretty good way to come home again. Finishing a project and saying, how did it manifest? Is it what I expected? Or has it become something else? And can I live with that? It's not quite what I thought of when I had that original vision. Guess what? That's where we all are when we begin our architectural plans, when we begin a book or a film or a script. It can go in several directions. Let me end this with two brief examples. I'm hosting a TV show now on Link TV called Global Spirit. We've just finished our 12th show with Deepak Chopra. I interviewed him 2 weeks ago. And one of the shows that's getting so much viewership, which you can see online now, by the way, globalspirittv.com, was about atonement and forgiving, forgiveness and healing, in which two psychologists that you see here with a bandana are taking Vietnam veterans back to Vietnam to the point of their trauma, the point where something so horrific took place that they have not been able to pull that shrapnel of memory out of them since. What they're doing is an act of atonement. They're allowing the vets to go back and start up schools or orphanages or buy water buffalo to help make up for all the water buffalo they killed for target practice 40 years ago. That show has resulted in a book on atonement. I didn't know when I'm doing this show that the creativity is going to move out this way. But the point here then is that creativity is so fluid, it can move in a way that will challenge and even deepen your life. So I want to end with this image, the cover I'm still fighting for my next book, which will come out next spring, called Word Catcher, in which I began as a book of just a little trivia, little fun facts about words, but which took me deeper and deeper and deeper into my love of books, language, communication. And I'll end with this little piece of synchronicity. The night before I handed in the manuscript and sent off all the artwork and so on, I was looking through one of these beautiful old leather-bound books of etymologies that I inherited from my father. And it had been stuck behind other books for a long time. I hadn't seen it. I open it up, and here's a note that he sent to me the week before he died. And it simply said, in shaky red magic marker, "Did my love of words influence you?" Oh my God, I couldn't breathe. It was so fantastic to find this. And so I've put that into the introduction of this book that says, there is a fire that someone passed on to us. It could be a father, a mother, a grandparent, a teacher, a coach. And if that fire has moved into us, we have a responsibility to keep that beauty of that fire, the gesture that someone made to ignite us at one point, and keep that fire, that creativity, that light moving through the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. I'd like to remind our listening audience at home that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California with Phil Cousineau today, Stoking the Creative Fire. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. I'm going to start the questioning, and then I'll be going around with the mic for people that do have questions. So, Phil, my question for you is, I know about some of the work you do in Hollywood, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, and also, are you able to apply the 9 steps here to having them do authentic work there, or is it really mercenary?
Yes, that's a great question. Thank you. Thank you all for coming there. I've been doing some consultation down at Warner Brothers and 20th Century Fox and a couple other studios, and I can tell you from experience that the script writers, the producers and directors get stuck in the same places as 7th grade English students, as beginning poets, as seasoned sculptors. That's why I believe so thoroughly and ardently in this pattern, because it's really a charting, a mapping of the growth of consciousness, the growth of ideas, the growth of creativity. And the three places that people get stuck, even in the great Hollywood studios, it's time, space, and focus. People putting work out too quickly or taking too much time. not being able to have the great authentic time that you need in your life to write a good script, and the ability to focus in meetings is a serious problem there as well. So one delightful turn of events for me in my work is that I've been called down probably a dozen times now into the studios to do what they call commentary for the second disc on mythology, the myth of movies. So I was called down to talk about the mythology of baseball in The Natural on the same day that Robert Redford was there because he was the star, and Jason Giambi was there, and Bob Costas, and they interviewed me about the myth behind this character. So now you can go to the double disc of The Natural, see the movie, but on the second disc, you have an opportunity to explore the numinous dimension of this movie. I've also done it now for several other movies, including the collected Charles Schulz, in which they asked me to talk about the archetypes of Charlie Brown, Lucy, and so on. There was a challenge for me to talk about Peanuts in terms of archetypes. But what I find delightful is that there is this great hunger right now in the country to want more than just the entertainment of the 90-minute movie. So people are asking, is there any other meaning here? Do these stories really connect with the old myths, fairy tales, legends, and so on? And my vote is yes, so that's been a delight for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, another question, please.
Well, I have another one then. Can you tell us what it was like to be friends and have a mentor in Joseph Campbell? I mean, you could talk all night about that, but just
yes,
maybe one highlight
certainly.
Of that.
Well, you guys know the story of Lana Turner being discovered in the drugstore on Sunset Boulevard in the 1940s. It's one of the archetypal discovery stories in the history of Hollywood. Well, I had my own Lana Turner moment in the early 80s when I was still house painting here in San Francisco, but I would go down monthly to meet with screenwriter friends down in Hollywood. We'd go to cafes or little pubs on the strip and talk about movies. And one day, I'm carrying on about Apocalypse Now and how they didn't come up with this out of thin air. This is based on The Heart of Darkness by Conrad, who then took that story from Homer's Odyssey and so on. So we're doing this with Pabst's films and about Pandora's Box and so on. Finally, I feel a tap on my shoulder, and a guy behind me leans back and says, I've been listening to you guys. Just as I'm turning beet red, right? And he says, I happen to work at the American Film Institute just up the street here, and we're looking for somebody to do something unusual in our workshops. Would you like to come and give a seminar on myth, dream, and the movies? And it was one of those moments where I could see the marquee. My life is changing, right? And so for a few years, I did these workshops around the country with Tom Schlesinger and Keith Cunningham on myth and movies. And they were absolutely delightful. No one was doing this. We were talking about the myths behind Star Wars and the Road Warrior and so on. And one day, someone in one of the workshops came up and said, I'm working on a film about Joe Campbell, and we're stuck. Using our metaphor of being stuck, we've ran out of gas. There's no more fire. There's no more juice. Think about all the metaphors here. Could you come and help us? So I drove from San Francisco down to San Diego on gas fumes. I used the last $17 I had to my name to drive all the way down the coast to spend 3 days with Joe Campbell to get the job. If I didn't get the job to work on this movie about his life, there was no way for Cousineau to get home again. But we spent 3 days talking about James Joyce, about Paris, about the life of running, because, you know, he was also the world's fastest half-miler in the 1920s. He came within a hundredth of a second of going to the 24 Paris Olympics. We talked about music because he was a saxophone player in a Greenwich Village jazz band. So we had electrical conversation. And what I noticed over 3 days of being with him, that he could talk mythologically about virtually any subject. If it was whiskey or a fried egg on the plate at breakfast, there was a myth there. And that got into me, that there are mythic numinous dimensions that are usually unexplored in our life. We don't have the time. We don't have the attention to explore it. Joe taught me that it was worth the time and the attention. And one other gift that he gave me that was tremendous. I showed him my wheel, as I showed you here, of the creative journey that I did for movies, in which you can look at virtually any movie in terms of the hero's journey, which pretty much goes through the three-act structure and so on. But I was nervous to show him what I've been doing, thinking, oh, he might accuse me of stealing his ideas and robbing. But what I was doing was adapting them. But I'll never forget. He patted me on the arm and he said, Phil, this is wonderful, because I was writing about myth and its connection with literature and the spiritual life over these last 50 years to reach artists and students, not academics. And then he paused and he said, just one thing, make it your own. And now I have that on an index card above my computer in my writing studio. If we're inspired in music, in art, in teaching, in business, we can borrow, we can adapt, but the beauty of it is that every one of these opportunities is a chance to put our own voice, our own mark, to make it our own. That was a wonderful gift that Joseph Campbell gave me. Thank you.
I had one question. Yes. So I was just interested about how you talked about the burnout, and could you just elaborate on the situation with yourself?
The question is about the stage of burnout. Burnout can happen in a couple of ways. One is that the work is beyond us. Sometimes we are overreaching, and that's a troublesome thing. Other times we're trying to cram too much work into too small a period of time. That can burn us out. The sheer intensity of focus as a writer, as a painter, as a musician, can also burn us out. You see all these fire metaphors here. And so what I try to build into every day and what I try to recommend to others is a release period, a moment of exercise, a moment of being exposed to the outdoors, a moment of some time of play so we don't take our work quite so seriously. A little silly time if you're fans of Monty Python. Burnout is destructive to us, to our own creative capacities, and to the people around us if we don't build in that play period. Also, we can have a burnout if we're doing work for the wrong reason, if we're doing it just for the money, if we're doing it just for the acclaim, if we're doing work that is unethical. It's going to torch us. We will have scars because of this. So sometimes the burnout, as Annie Dillard, any of you know her work, wonderful writer, a naturalist writer, she says, speaking of, yeah, here we go, that if sometimes the burnout is actually a kind of smoke signal from the soul. I'm paraphrasing now. But what she's suggesting is if you're feeling that sense of being torched, it's your own spiritual dimension, your own soul telling you that there's something wrong with the work and that you need to attend to that. That's why a lot of musicians stop touring. That's why a lot of writers stop going on the road, because the price is too high to pay. So my simple solution or recommendation with that is bringing more of a sense of play into the work. Yes. Do we have time for one more?
Yes, we have. That's exactly where we're at in the program right now. We have time for one more question. Right. Does someone have a question? Well, I've got plenty of questions, Phil, because I love your work. So,
yeah, thanks.
Could you tell us a little bit about how the thing that I know in your work that's gone throughout all of your work is soul, and how do you see holding on? This is a little bit beyond the creative process. This is more like the survival process. Today, with everything happening in the world, with the economic crisis, and how people have really done some things that are just not so great, and how do you advise us to hold on to our soul and hold on to our optimism?
Well, that's a very large question. A number of years ago, I